Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Just as the nature of the financial crisis has changed the longer it's gone on, so too have the ideas for how to make sure something like it never happens again. The president was talking healthcare today, but elsewhere in the White House, financial regulations were topic one. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done, online at elance.com. And by Superbrands, Brandweek's annual ranking and analysis of America's top 2,000 brands. You can Google Brandweek Superbrands for more information.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Monday today, the 15th of June, and it is great to have you here. This is one of those occasions when we can give you tomorrow's news today, or better yet, we are going to give you Wednesday's news. The president is going to be giving a big speech that day. He's going to lay out his plans for overhauling the financial markets, plans that Wall Street and Congress have been waiting for a while now. Thanks to an opinion piece in the Washington Post this morning, we have a pretty good idea of what he's going to say. The byline in the paper today was Timothy Geithner and Lawrence Summers. The Treasury Secretary and the Director of the National Economic Council wrote that the White House wants to beef up the powers of the Federal Reserve, wants to rein in hedge funds and derivatives, and create a new regulator to protect consumers. The press is on to move quickly on this before the moment for real reform is passed, although some worry it already has. Our New York Bureau Chief Amy Scott has the story.
Back in March, Secretary Geithner spoke of plans to overhaul the financial system.
To address this will require comprehensive reform, not modest repairs at the margin, but new rules of the game.
Nearly 3 months later, the administration is close to finalizing its strategy. With the crisis easing, critics say the White House is watering down those plans.
It may be a lost opportunity, especially in an environment in which now some people are saying perhaps the worst is behind us.
Jim Barth is a fellow at the pro-market Milken Institute. He was hoping for a more streamlined system, but it looks as though an idea to merge the regulators of securities and commodity futures is off the table, and the patchwork of agencies that oversee the financial system will remain almost undisturbed. Barth says it may have been too difficult to get members of Congress, regulators, and the financial lobby to cede ground.
You have all these different individuals and players who are trying to basically either prevent regulatory reform or what they're trying to do is be sure they still have a seat at the table.
As it is now, financial institutions can shop around for the sleepiest watchdog. Often they chose the Office of Thrift Supervision. It was AIG's main regulator. It's been accused of being weak at best, fraudulent at worst. It might now be folded into another agency. Patricia McCoy teaches securities law at the University of Connecticut. She welcomes other steps, like creating a council to watch out for systemic risk and a new agency to oversee products like mortgages and mutual funds.
Those are significant steps. We need more, but I'd be happy for the moment to at least get these things done.
Officials understand the moment for real reform could slip away. At an event this morning, Secretary Geithner said the White House is trying to act quickly before complacency sets back in. In New York, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
This is clearly a big speech week for the president. Mr. Obama was in Chicago today. He spent an hour or so with the American Medical Association to continue his campaign for health care reform. There was a fair amount of applause from a group that's been painted recently as not totally on board with changes to the nation's healthcare system. There was a boo or two as well at a couple of points. The president warned the nation's doctors that if we don't cut healthcare costs, the whole country could wind up like General Motors. Jill Barshay reports now that for doctors, overhauling America's healthcare system hasn't been about the if, really. It's about the how.
When it comes to fixing healthcare, doctors have been like uncooperative patients. Les Funleiter is a healthcare industry analyst at Miller Tabak in New York.
The AMA has been one of the organizations that have been scuttling health care reform since Franklin Roosevelt. So I think it would be helpful to have them on his side.
President Obama agrees.
I need your help, doctors, because to most Americans, you are the health care system. The fact is, Americans, and I include myself and Michelle and our kids in this, We just do what you tell us to do.
But not when it comes to medical malpractice. Obama disappointed doctors today when he said he would not recommend caps on malpractice awards. Robert Leshefsky is a healthcare policy analyst in Washington. He says what's really at stake for the doctors is their livelihood and how reform may redistribute the wealth.
Some of them are cardiologists who are paid really well and are making great livings, and some of them are pediatricians that are barely hanging on. But if you try to cut specialists and give the money to primary care, you'll probably have a civil war between the physicians.
Leshefsky says that the American Medical Association isn't as powerful as it used to be. It represents only a third of the nation's 800,000 doctors. But he says the one thing they can agree on is they don't want a pay cut. I'm Jill Barshay for Marketplace.
How much doctors and hospitals and the rest of the healthcare industry are compensated for their work is only one of many problems that any system-wide fix is going to have to cover. And those problems are interrelated. They're constantly changing, and they are intensely personal. I asked healthcare economist Glenn Milnick why the president is tackling such a difficult topic right now when he's got so many other things on his plate.
The reason the administration is pushing so hard is because the numbers show that the healthcare spending by the government, if something isn't done, will consume the federal budget sometime around 2030. And so between Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security, that will take 100% of the federal budget, leaving nothing left over for defense or anything else. Then the question is, how do you get a control of healthcare spending and at the same time add potentially another 50 million people into the healthcare system, a large fraction of whom will be have to be subsidized by the government?
Think for a second about all the places where savings could come. Where are we going to be able to save those tens of millions of dollars that are going to make any kind of healthcare change real?
A centerpiece of the plan is this idea of information technology. And I certainly, you know, the healthcare system certainly is a ripe candidate to become more computerized and digitized. So that will save some money because there's lots of duplication, lots of paperwork and things like that. But even if we digitize and computerize the entire system, administrative costs are not going to go to zero. There's still going to be some administrative costs, and that's going to be a one-time savings. We get those costs out of the system, but the rate of growth is really what the government needs to slow down through government regulation, controlling the prices that are paid for providers.
If you assume that the American Medical Association and doctors' groups and hospitals in this country are going to have to go along with any health care change and reform, how do you do it and convince them that what they're doing has to become less expensive to the rest of us? That is, that some of the costs have to come from them, some of those savings.
Well, I think, you know, that's going to be a very difficult sell, in my opinion. I think, you know, when the president talks about cost efficiencies and helping doctors to do what they do better, more cost effectively, I think they're for that. The real problem, though, is that in order for the administration to generate savings to pay for these programs, it's going to have to pay doctors and hospitals less, and as time goes on, a lot less than they're being paid now. And I think that's going to be a very difficult sell.
Well, let me make sure I understand that. If doctors and hospitals are making less money, what does that do for the quality of care? I'm just trying to think about the argument that's going to come up on Capitol Hill on this one.
Quality will have to suffer in some way, whether it's through reduced access, whether it's through slower development of new technology. There are a number of economists who feel that that healthcare is expensive for a good reason, and that the reason is that it's valuable, that new innovation and new technology, while it may add to the cost of the healthcare system, also brings with it tremendous benefits. The real challenge is, can we develop a system to do the research to identify those things that are going to be high value in the first place and to screen out those things that are low value and not adopt them as quickly as we have in the past? And that will be a challenge, but I think there's potential savings there. I don't know any country that's done it very well so far. Because new innovation is just so complex and hard to predict.
Glenn Milnick is a healthcare economist with the RAND Corporation, also at the University of Southern California. Glenn, thanks a lot.
My pleasure, Kyle.
If your next trip to the doctor's office happens to take you past a gas station, make a note of the price. AAA said this morning today's the 48th straight day that pump prices have gone up. $2.67 a barrel is the nationwide average. Crude oil gave up ground today. It was down 2%. The major stock indexes, They gave up more than that. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There are more signs of economic distress out there than anybody likes to count. Businesses closing, people losing their jobs, consumers aren't buying, so global trade is down. The World Trade Organization says overall world exports will shrink by about 9% this year. And that is giving people living along a stretch of river in southwest England their own trade indicator. When business is bad, their quiet backwater becomes a parking place for empty ocean-going cargo ships. From Cornwall, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome on board the Queen of the Fowl.
A group of tourists set off on a scenic cruise, taking in the sights along the beautiful River Fowl in Cornwall, the wooded hillsides, the castles, the creeks and the coves, and the 20,000-ton ocean-going freighters.
There you are. That's the larger of the ships there. She carries 1,200 cars.
Laid up along this short stretch of river, 8 miles from the sea, there are 10 huge vessels, tankers, car carriers and container ships. The visitors' reactions are mixed.
We've come for a little cruise up the River Fowl today and surprised to see these ships here. Not exactly a tourist attraction. A bit of an eyesore, really.
You don't expect it. You don't think that the river would cope with such big vessels at all, yeah. And then so many of them, yeah, that's quite interesting to see.
Local mariner Peter Newman runs the scenic cruise. He lives on the riverbank in a house called Smuggler's Cottage. The ship owners pay him a fee to keep an eye on the 10 freighters and check their moorings.
We never get any ships breaking adrift or any problems, dragging or anything.
Or running aground?
Or running aground, no.
The estuary is a rear, a drowned valley, one of the deepest in the country and well protected from the elements. Newman says it's an ideal place to park a giant ship.
They're very secure and, of course, the owners know that and They can sleep at night, you might say.
The River Fowl has provided a layup for big ships for many years. Mooring fees are relatively inexpensive, around $1,000 a week. When trade is poor and cargoes are dwindling, it's much cheaper to lay up in the Fowl than keep a ship at sea with a full crew waiting for orders. Local harbour master Andy Brigden says that makes the Fowl a terrific economic indicator.
It is the barometer of trade, really. You know, when the ships are no longer there, when that place is empty, then the world's economy is doing very, very well. And it has been empty, I mean, for a good nearly 10 years.
The freighters suddenly began to arrive last October. There were 10 by December. Every day, Brigden gets a request from another ship owner, but he's adamant he doesn't want to take any more vessels.
I think there would be quite a few people who would be upset if we packed the entire estuary full of ships. You know, I think we've got to be good neighbours, like any other harbour authority, and, you know, 10's quite enough for us. It's doing, you know, wonders for our bank balance at the moment.
OK, thank you very much. Woo, one step.
Local mariner Peter Newman is also doing nicely out of the freighters. They give him another talking point on his scenic trips down the river. He makes money occasionally ferrying people to and from the ships. He says he'll be sorry to see them eventually weigh anchor and leave, but when they do, it'll be a good sign for the rest of us. It'll show the tide has turned for the global economy. On the River Fowl in Cornwall, this is Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Halfway. That's it for the day, folks. Going home.
Coming up, after 40 years, how a shoe company stays hot.
You know, at the end of the day, what you're doing is you're capturing cool.
But first, let's do the numbers. Investors looked hard for encouraging signs today. They found the cupboards bare. The Dow Industrials fell 187 points, 2.1%, closed at 8,612. The blue chips did. The NASDAQ slipped 42 points, 2.2%, landed at 1816. The S&P 500 lost 22 points, about a 2.3% there, wrapped up at 923. Sagging metal prices weighed heavily on commodity producers. Aluminum maker Alcoa sank 6.5% today. Mining equipment manufacturer Caterpillar dug down 4.25%. Copper and gold producer Freeport-McMoRan tumbled 5.75%. Falling crude snuffed out the lights on energy shares. That always happens. Chevron dropped almost 2.25% today. ExxonMobil slid 1.25%. ConocoPhillips dropped almost 3%. Bond prices rose. That nudged the yield on the 10-year T-note down to 3.7%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, offering breaking news, exclusive stories, and insights that impact today's financial markets. More at newsfirst.reuters.com. And by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. Produce more, conserve more.com. We've got all the business news worth talking about on our new blog. Scott Jagow hosts the Marketplace Scratchpad. You can check in with him throughout the trading day at marketplace.org. Here's a look at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Tuesday. The Commerce Department reports on new home construction for May. The Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee holds a hearing titled Greener Communities, Greater Opportunities, New Ideas for Sustainable Development and Economic Growth. And the Detroit Economic Club continues hosting the National Summit. The focus is on America's competitiveness in technology, energy, environment, and manufacturing. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. We have told you often enough of the billions in borrowing that the federal government is doing to finance its various bailout and stimulus programs, and how the market for most of those IOUs, also known as treasury bills, is overseas. Well, take what I'm about to tell you as an early warning indicator that Uncle Sam might be close to maxing out our collective credit card. Today, the Treasury Department reported a plunge in foreign purchases of long-term U.S. government debt. It fell to $11 billion in April from $55 billion the month before. Three of America's biggest creditors, that'd be China, Japan, and Russia, all cut back on their holdings of U.S. debt. And our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports that they are not the only ones getting anxious over the exploding U.S. deficit.
The government has relied mainly on two ways to raise the vast sums of cash it's using to prop up the teetering economy: printing it or borrowing it with the sale of government bonds. S&P chief economist David Weiss says since most Americans don't have much money to spare these days, Uncle Sam has had to reach beyond our borders with hat in hand.
We've just become very dependent on foreigners, given that Americans don't want to save money anymore. So we're running up this huge deficit in savings within the United States, which has to be made up by foreign money.
But that quick cash will dry up if foreigners start doubting we can back the greenback.
That means they're not buying dollars, and that means the dollar is going to be weaker, which means imports are going to cost more than they do now.
There could be more dominoes if foreigners pull more investments and keep pushing down long-term treasury prices. Marilyn Cohen heads Envision Capital Management. She says the struggling housing market could be dealt a fresh blow by an unwelcome side effect of higher bond yields.
It's long-term mortgage rates, because the treasury market is the driver for the mortgage rates. And it's going to be a wonderful excuse for the credit card companies and lenders to keep their rates up and not lower them.
President Obama has vowed to reduce the deficit as soon as the economic situation permits, but Cohen remains wary.
It's ridiculous for people to think that we're going to be able to borrow our way out of this financial crisis. Certainly we have to at the beginning, but unless it's reined in very, very quickly down the road, it will get uglier.
Cohen says foreign investors are clearly signaling it's time for the U.S. to control its spending. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
If you don't happen to be a fan of the U.S. bond market and you're still somewhat leery of the stock market, There's a New York brokerage firm that's got something completely different for you. For the first time since the war started in 2003, Iraqi securities are going to be available to foreign investors. From New York, Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
Auerbach Grayson isn't your typical Wall Street firm. The chairman, Jonathan Auerbach, sports a faded blue open-collar shirt, a shark-tooth necklace, and two bracelets from Africa. He's the very image of the man you'd expect to be the first selling Iraqi stocks to Americans.
I've been doing this business in frontier markets for 16 years. I've never had a trade that failed, and I see no reason why Iraq's going to be any different.
One reason Auerbach's getting into the Iraqi market now is that Baghdad's stock exchange recently swapped their whiteboards for an electronic trading system. Most of the stocks being traded are banks. Oh, and there's this.
The GDP of Iraq is $125 billion in round numbers. The market cap is about $3 billion. That means the market's cheap.
So, he says, the gains could be enormous. Bartle Bull is an investment banker who's been focusing solely on Iraq for years. Speaking with me from nearby Qatar, he said it helps that Iraq's economy is pretty disconnected from the rest of the world.
Last year, when the global emerging markets stock indexes were down about 55%, the Iraqi market was up about 10%.
But what about security? Bull says terrorist attacks don't move the market in Baghdad much these days.
Fewer people are killed in Iraq than in all sorts of countries that investors are more comfortable with, including, on a per capita basis, Mexico.
Oh, but before you go running to put all your money in the Bank of Baghdad, Auerbach Grayson only takes investments from big institutions like mutual funds. Sorry. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
There are millions of surfers and skateboarders and snowboarders in this country, most of them under the age of 30. That's a lot of kids with a lot of consumer clout, especially when it comes to deciding what kind of clothes to buy. In an industry where being hip can count for almost everything, Vans has been right in the thick of that mix for 40 years. The thick, rubber-soled, canvas-top shoes the company made its name with found fame among skateboarders and surfers back in the 1970s, including Sean Penn's character, Spicoli, from the movie Fast Times at Ridgemont High.
Why don't you get a job, Spicoli?
What for?
You need money.
All I need are some tasty waves, cool buzz, and I'm fine.
Penn's black and white checkered Vans catapulted the shoes and the company into the mainstream. But Vans marketing vice president Doug Palladini says the brand didn't really start out that way.
One thing to remember, when we started in 1966, Paul Van Doren didn't even know what skateboarding really was about at that point. Action sports, as we know them today, wasn't a big business.
It is now. Action sports retail brings in about $30 billion a year. Doug Palladini looks back at Vans' place in the market in the company's new book, Vans Off the Wall. And after a sneak preview of shoe styles and clothing designs that consumers won't see for a year and a half, I asked him how Vans initially caught on.
We distributed shoes through studios in Hollywood here and there, and Sean Penn had grown up in Santa Monica, wearing our shoes, and when he wore them in Fast Times.
Playing Spicoli, right? He wore his own shoes,
Spicoli,
didn't he?
Yeah, and it was real authentic because he grew up right in that area.
Is it true what I read that you went from like a $20 million company to a $40 million company after that film came out? I mean, that's the trajectory that it helped you get on?
It did, and it was a double-edged sword for us because we did it and we grew exponentially, but without any sort of discipline whatsoever. So anyone who would call up and want the shoes, we asked how many we could send and where they needed them sent.
Walk me through how it happened that this not very desirable demographic back in the mid '70s, the skateboarder hanging out, shiftless youth kind of demographic, made this company what it is, really. I mean, how did that happen?
You have to remember that back when the company started, the general mindset in the advertising community was that teens were not an audience worth reaching. It's like, what are you going to do with a kid's paper route money? How are you going to make a business out of that? So what we now know is vacations, cars, appliances, kids have a tremendous influence over all of that.
How do you keep going with this brand that has evolved really not very much in the last 40 years, right? I mean, it was cool shoes then, and it's cool shoes and some other stuff now.
What we always try to do is dive back into what makes us original and authentic. And it's almost going back that allows us to move forward. You know, we've had times in our past and we've been through bankruptcy where we've tried to reach beyond who we are as a brand. We've made wrestling shoes, clown shoes, skydiving shoes. We did a whole running
thing. Special shoes for skydiving.
Yes. Don't ask me. We did a whole running initiative. And those are the kind of places where we get too far afield that, and really, it's not a part of who we are anymore.
Give me your take on the myth or the legend that is Vans. I mean, what is it? Encapsulate it for me.
It is that Southern California culture of music, art, action sports, street culture, all wrapped together around this basic-looking shoe. That is really what it is.
And how does that stay relevant today in a country that's so different from 45 years ago when the company started and when, frankly, we've got a whole bunch of other problems?
You know, at the end of the day, what you're doing is you're capturing cool.
Since we were there, I figured I had to recapture a little bit of that cool for myself on the indoor skate ramp that Vans has at its offices. Doug Palladini helped me out with step one, figuring out which foot to lead with on the skateboard.
You're goofy-footed.
What does that mean?
That means your right foot's forward.
Really?
Generally, when you get pushed, when you don't know and you get pushed, whichever foot you put out first is... So try it that way.
Yeah, so I did.
There you go. Thank you.
Hear that thump and then the applause from the guys there? That's me falling right on my backside. I don't know. Maybe a pair of Vans might have helped me out. To check out some pictures from our visit and from Palladini's book, go to our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, if you're a basketball fan, you already know the Los Angeles Lakers won the NBA championship last night, 4-1 over the Orlando Magic. With the title, of course, comes the obligatory parade for the winners, complete with overtime for police officers, traffic cops, and cleanup crews, none of whom come cheap, especially in a city that's trying to cut hundreds of millions of dollars from its budget. So we learned today the team is going to split the $2 million cost of the parade with the city right down the middle. Me? Don't blame me. I wanted Orlando all the way on that one. Anyway, that's Marketplace from American Public Media this Monday afternoon. Today, the Dow tumbled 187 points, 2.1%. The NASDAQ slid 42 points, 2.2%. The S&P 500 gave up 22 points, 2.3% there. Our producers include Caitlin Carroll, Millie Jefferson, Megan Larson, and Fiona Ng. Marketplace was created by Jim Russell. Coming up next time on the broadcast, having a baby is a big change to anybody's life. But in a recession?
There's more than 4 million babies born every year. So that's a lot of decisions. And, of course, there are some non-decisions.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.